From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. Immaturity and impotent rage. It's a line from writer-director Henry Bean's new movie, Noise, but it could apply to many of the characters in his other films, in Deep Cover, for example, or Internal Affairs, or his debut as a writer-director, The Believer. His characters are often kind of caught in this sort of immaturity and impotent rage, and they seek justice in the most self-destructive ways. I'm going to have Henry talk about this a little bit. First of all, Henry, welcome to the show. Thanks very much.
And I think when you say impotent rage, you're absolutely right.
You wrote impotent rage.
Well, he says his movie. His wife says to him in the movie, "What are you so angry about?" And he says, "'Cause I'm impotent." And she, her heart goes out to him. She's not always, not even that often. He says, "Not always sexually, but always, always." And that's how it is. Out of that spirit that film was created. It was out of the sense of my impotence before things that drove me crazy and I could do nothing about, that this movie came.
So there's a kind of autobiographical aspect to this film.
Well, it's true that I did some of the things you see in the movie.
First of all, tell the listeners what the film's about.
The film is called Noise, and it is about a man played by Tim Robbins who is being driven crazy by the noise in New York City. And he starts out by doing small things like letting the air out of tires whose alarms are going off, or pulling the windshield wipers off their cars, kicking out the headlights, all sorts of little things you can do quickly and get away with. But one night, there's a car that's been going, an alarm that's been going for several hours outside of his building. And he goes out and he breaks the window and he pops the hood, and he's just disconnecting the battery cable when the police come and arrest him. And that happened to me. And in fact, we filmed it in exactly the spot where I was arrested. And it matches up with my arrest in a lot of details. But what happened at that point to me was I stopped doing this. I spent a lot of money. I actually was represented by a lawyer named Elliot Spitzer in that event.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
It was briefly between being a prosecutor and running for public office, and he was great. He was a wonderful lawyer, and he did right by me, and I remember him fondly for that. But when it was all over, I was out a few thousand dollars, and I said, I have to stop doing this or it's going to be ridiculous. But I started to think about someone who wouldn't stop, someone who, even though it was destroying his finances and then subsequently his marriage and his health, couldn't stop doing it because whatever it was that was driving him crazy there wouldn't let him go. And it seemed wrong to him. And his deep sense that this was wrong, even though the subject matter was fairly trivial to other people and in certain sense even to himself, even despite that, he couldn't let go. And I was curious about this man who feels that he has something that he thinks is right and that he must do and has to do no matter what the consequences.
Well, one of the things that fascinates me about the film too is that there's a lot of comic aspects to it. I mean, I think in a way that sort of makes it feel like it's a lot less subversive than it actually is. I mean, there's an element of humor that gives it a kind of simplicity. As we were saying earlier, it feels a bit to me like Monsieur Hulot's Holiday.
The tati is very important. The tati of Monsieur Hulot and of Playtime very much were important to me. You know, I thought The Believer was going to be a comedy. In fact, to me, The Believer still is sort of a comedy.
How do you mean?
The idea of a Jewish Nazi and of a guy who—
It's certainly absurd.
The Believer is a film I made a while ago about a Jewish Nazi. It's absurd, but the underlying joke of that movie is the harder he tries to hide his Jewishness, the more obvious it is that he's Jewish. And to me, when I watch the movie, it's very funny. And I think Ryan Gosling, who played the guy in the film, got the humor of it. But this time out, I was committed to making what was actually perceived by other people to be a comedy. And the strategy was to make the surface of the film silly and seemingly trivial, because I thought that what was beneath it, the way in which we must suffer power and the way in which we suffer abuse and our helplessness, our impotence, is so painful that if dealt with directly and dealt with openly, it would be unbearable. So I tried to make a movie which on the surface was a silly movie about a guy who was pursuing a silly subject, noise, and bury the other stuff inside it.
Well, what fascinates me about it, though, it's the first film you've made that, rather than being about emotional wreckage or human wreckage, is about physical wreckage. I mean, there's actual damage taking place in this film.
There is. one of the things about the making the film was that Tim loved doing that. And you know, Tim is a big, burly guy, but when he starts to move physically, he's incredibly graceful. I think it comes partly from being a musician.
But it's also, again, it's like watching Tati is Mijoula.
That's right. That's right. It's the dance of destruction that he's doing. And you feel when he's doing this stuff that he's as happy as he's ever going to be. And he was indeed very happy doing it.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean. His new film as writer-director is Noise. And one of the things we hear in this movie that you never hear or rarely hear in movies is the noise of car alarms, which are omnipresent here in New York and almost in any major city. You're constantly hearing them. And I didn't realize how much you blocked them out until I was watching the movie.
Right, right. And we did not – we added them sometimes, but by and large, we made a decision in production. You know, one of the most difficult things about shooting a film, especially in a city like New York, is the sound recording. And you're forever having to stop takes and – start again because there's a plane overhead, because there's a truck nearby, because there was a backfire, because there's an alarm. And we just said, we're going to go with that. We're going to record that. We're going to take that stuff in the production, and we're going to live with it in the final film. Now, the sound recorder will always tell you, don't do it. If you really want that sound, lay it in post. And there are two things wrong with that, I think. One is that when you lay it in post, it never feels, just orally, it never feels like it really belongs in the scene. It always has a kind of cocoon of silence around it. It's not integrated with the other sounds. But even more important, it's not integrated into the performance. And when actors hear those sounds in performance, in very subtle but telling ways, they integrate that sound into their performance. And if you add the sounds afterwards, the performance and sounds have nothing to do with each other. They're just laid in. So I'm very happy we did that. And occasionally in theaters without good sound systems, it's a little bit hard to hear the dialogue here and there, but I'm willing to live with that.
I guess it's interesting for me just hearing that, and that constant sort of buzz is there.
Right.
I mean, not only just the sounds of the sirens and the car alarms, but just a buzz is always going on. It's like the movie is constantly vibrating in that way that the city does.
Yes.
Because it's always being shaken and air is being disturbed by those sounds.
That's right. There's no, as Cage said, there's no such thing as silence. And that presents other problems. But that was what we wanted to get. We wanted to get the sense that there was always a teeming city out there. Even if you didn't see it, you would hear it, and it would constantly be disturbing things. And some of my favorite moments in the film are the moments when this guy who's obsessed with car alarms is so involved in a conversation with his wife that a car alarm's going, he doesn't even hear it. Because so much of what he's complaining about as objective sound is, of course, subjective sound. And what drives you crazy one minute, you don't even hear.
Well, it's a great funny scene when he runs into somebody on the street where he's complaining about one sound from a buzzer and the other guy's complaining about something else. And you realize it's exactly that point you're talking about.
Right, right. And he goes up into that guy's apartment and hears the sound which drives that guy crazy, which is the sound of a manhole cover clunking when something goes over. And he can't believe that this guy is so obsessed with that thing. Just as so many people have been saying to him through the whole movie, why are you so bothered by this? And I try to make in a certain way a movie about a whole city full of people who are obsessed with different things.
One of the great things about watching Tim is that watching that wariness of his, you know, just how his eyes get smaller as he's concentrating and just he must have been key to you in the conception of the film.
He's fantastic and he's an incredibly intuitive and subtle actor, so that he's always registering different shifts in the landscape, in the oral landscape, and in the other characters, and in the progression of his character. He plots the progression of his character through the film into madness and, in a certain sense, beyond madness.
And the film gets crazy and crazy and becomes more fable-like as it goes on. And it's a kind of realism. But the sound, and we were talking about this earlier, almost becomes kind of like this weird clarion call to him. It's like it's seeking him out.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, as two moments that I think exemplify that are one when his wife, realizing what a deep end he's going off, says, why don't we see if that house in Nyack is still for sale? And he says, I'm not moving to Nyack. He's not going to leave the world where these sounds drive him crazy. He's attached to these sounds. He wants to be driven crazy by them. He's addicted to being driven crazy. And later in the film, a young Russian woman he meets, says to him, so you were living on the Upper West Side where it was relatively quiet, and then you move down here where it's twice as loud. And he has no – and why did you do that? And he has no answer to that. And she's onto this. She says, because you want to hear this noise. The impotent rage – that is driving you crazy is also freeing you in a certain way. Because impotent rage is safe. You can be furious as you want and nothing's going to happen. It's the rage that actually does something. The rage that actually threatens to change the world that's scary. To make things different is scary. To scream like an angry child is very easy. So in the early parts of this film, he's an angry child, and he's just acting out his fury. But when he meets her, she tries to lead him down the path of actually doing something, which he's very reluctant to go on. And in the end, I think he puts together a synthesis of his rage and of the legal system to try and, you know, to accomplish a tiny little victory for himself.
That's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean, who, as a director's first film, was The Believer's new film as a writer-director, is Noise. I guess I just found myself wondering how people react to that, because the movie does get crazy. I mean, crazier and crazier. I mean, it almost goes from being Dostoevsky to Kafka.
Well, two of my favorites. I think that the thing that audiences differ on, some people think he's crazy. What's wrong with this guy that he's doing it? I don't think he's crazy at all. I think he's being driven crazy, and he's acting in actually a very rational way. That is, his action is a relief of his action, his violence against cars, his getting in trouble, even his getting arrested, is a way of saying what's happening to me is unbearable. And if I don't act this way, I'm acting like it's bearable when it's unbearable. So even if I'm destroying my life, I'm expressing what I feel, and I'm responding to the pressure I experience. And that makes sense to me, because if I didn't, I would crack.
But see, you say rational, and to me, I feel like he's setting into motion these things by acting out that leads to the end, but then leads to this kind of cacophony of both violence and noise.
Right. He's doing that, but he's doing it not out of a – certainly not at the beginning. He's not doing it out of any kind of rational plan. It's at the beginning of this movie, he has no idea why he's doing this, except that he's incredibly angry, and that every time he goes out and breaks into a car, and I can tell you, I've gone out and broken into cars, you feel fantastic.
Do you?
When you disarm one of those alarms, when you get it to stop, you feel empowered. You feel like there was something driving me crazy, and I dealt with it. And I risked arrest, I risked all kinds of trouble, but I did it and I got away with it and it stopped now and I'm still here. It's an incredibly, I mean, it's a tiny little trivial aspect of this, but I as somebody who's done it, I can tell you it feels fantastic.
But it's this fascinating thing too, because it's, again, all these guys, all these protagonists that you've written about in your films and to some extent your literature too, are all people who are driven by this need to be self-destructive. I mean, there's an appetite for ruining their lives.
But I think that's absolutely right. But listen, I think that what we call self-destructive is often the prelude to some kind of transformation, or at least to the possibility of transformation. People who want to commit – people who think about suicide are often thinking not about killing themselves in a biological sense, but killing the self that they've been living that they don't want to live with anymore. And they would like to be reborn as someone else. For some people, that's impossible, and for some people, it's not like that. But I think that this kind of self-destructiveness is a way of tearing down what's there in the hope that you can at least be rid of it and possibly create something in its place.
So you're talking about this leading to a rebirth, except with the exception of the character here, there's not a rebirth for these people, your protagonists, really. I mean,
well, I think Danny in The Believer, he goes from a simple kind of neo-Nazi anti-Semitism to an understanding of how complex that is. So that in the latter portions of that movie, Danny is by day a Nazi and by night a rabbi. And in that impossible paradox, he finds true life. He hated being a Jew, but he finds being a Nazi kind of boring. But to be a Jew and a Nazi at the same time, to be a living contradiction, that seems to him like true life. And though it's unstable, though you can't go on being that, and he can't because the two sides find out about each other and he's destroyed, during the interval when he lives like that, he's living a happy life or a true life.
The life of the artist.
All right. Maybe so. Maybe so.
We'll take a break. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean. His new film is Noise. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. More to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean. His debut as writer-director was The Believer, and his new film is Noise. But we were talking before, and there is a kind of sacrifice that these guys end up making, though. These guys, these divided lives, end up sacrificing a part of themselves. And it's almost they're seeking martyrdom. I mean, and that's that kind of self-destructive quality. And it certainly happens to a great extent here in Noise as well, that kind of need for martyrdom that these guys have.
They have a need. I think, you know, you use the word sacrifice. There's something incredibly compelling about the concept of sacrifice and about the concept of sacrificing oneself, particularly if you can imagine that when that's all over, you'll go on. Danny doesn't go on in The Believer, and Gear doesn't go on in Internal Affairs, but Fishburne does go on in Deep Cover. And I think ridding yourself of something, expelling something, is in some very visceral way a powerful impulse. So that sacrificing for David Owen, the character played by Tim Robbins in this film, sacrificing his job, his marriage, his family, his home, potentially his health, this has a deep appeal to him. This makes him think, if I get rid of all of that, if I strip all of that away, if I give up everything I have, I'll enter another realm where life is better than it is here.
It's funny, too, because so much of this for these guys, I mean, the women who suffer these men.
Yes.
I always find to be really – I mean, that's where the comedy comes for me, is watching the women just deal with these guys.
Well, you know, these I do think the women don't just sit there. They give them a hard time. And there's nothing I like better than
– at some point, they all say why to these guys.
They all say why, or they all say no, or they say I'm not putting up with this anymore. I mean, I think Bridget Moynihan, who plays Tim's wife in this, is very skillful in the way she won't take any more than she has to, and yet at the same time is willing to forgive and bring him back.
Well, she wants to try to find a way to forgive, which I find fascinating. And she wants to be, in this weird way, if she thinks that she's the adult, he'll step up and be the adult he's capable of being.
And yet, I think that by the end of the movie, just before they get back together, she begins to appreciate that he's taken his rage and transformed it into something else, and that he's actually doing something instrumental with it in the world. In a way, one of my favorite moments in the movie is I don't know whether I give away more than I should, but they're outside the pizzeria, they're outside that restaurant after they've split up, while they're apart, and Bridget gives him a lovely kiss, and you know from that kiss that they're going to get back together, and yet in that moment, instead of getting back together, he goes off with his new girlfriend, she goes off with her new boyfriend, and they go off to their relationships outside of the marriage, but with a free, but knowing that they love each other. And I always think when I see that moment that this is the happiest moment they're ever going to have in their relationship, when they know they love each other and they can let each other go.
In talking about these things, they sound like incredible abstractions, but you've got to make them drama. I mean, you can't just have people talking about these things.
Yes.
Or right. Else it sounds like this conversation.
Right. Well, you know, I tried to begin the movie with what I thought was an essay about, let me tell you something about car alarms. He doesn't say that. He says something like that. And then to plant within that essay the elements of the narrative that would then assemble itself into a narrative and would become narrative. And that's right. You have to make drama out of it. But I very much like that the ideas and the drama remain in a certain tension, that you feel that in any moment the movie could turn back to ideas even as it remains being a drama. You know, the movies that I thought about in particular that I thought had some of this quality, and I only say them generically because I love them for that, Buñuel's early film L'Âge d'Or, which to me is one of the great political films of all time, even though there's no explicit politics in it.
But certainly there's a politic to the film, but there's also that sense of absurdity in the film,
the sense
too.
Of absurdity and in a certain sense the sense of revolution that the film seems to say to you. When the film's over, you think, if the audience doesn't tear off its clothes and throw itself on each other in an orgy, they've missed the point. This movie doesn't go that far. I wish it could have. I wish I could have.
But there's something weirdly – can you talk about that? And there's something, I think, orgiastic for him about about breaking
these
things.
That's right. There's something orgiastic. The sex scenes in this movie are the destruction of automobiles. And he loves it that way. And Tim loves it that way. It's one of the great things about his performance is that you feel the rage and joy at the same time in his doing that. And he adored doing it. He could have done it day and night. He never got tired of breaking cars.
But you were saying, are there other movies, too, that came to mind?
The other movie that I thought of that mixed the narrative with the idea is the Dusan Makhachev film, W.R., the film about Will Wilhelm
Mysteries Wright. Of the Organism, yeah.
Mysteries of the Organism. The story of the young woman with the Russian ice skater. That was narrative. It's more, it's pushed further toward the essay than my film is. But I like that. I like that kind of a film very much. And, of course, Godard does a lot of that himself.
And at a certain point, you ask the audience to detach, or those filmmakers allow the audience to detach in a way that you don't want for this.
Well, you know, maybe if I were better, I would do that. You know, I think a guy like Brecht, who, of course, is the model for Godard, Brecht can go back and forth between polemic and poetry, between the ideas that preoccupy him and a kind of fable-like storytelling in which you forget all about the ideas, or the ideas are so embodied in normal human reactions that that's how you experience them. And I think that travel back and forth between abstraction and the concrete is very, very exciting. And one doesn't have to lose the narrative. You know, do you know the wonderful novel by Hermann Brock called The Sleepwalkers?
Yeah, sure.
Trilogy of, and in the third section of that novel called The Realist, you go back and forth in alternating chapters between the narrative as it proceeds and Brock's pieces of an essay called The Decline of Values or something like that. And the two feed each other. It's almost like they're two texts, but they work together. You know, another film that does that is the way in which L'Amour Fou, the film by Jacques Rivette, uses the Corneille text that the people in the film are putting on a production of. And I think you can go back and forth between abstract and concrete, and if you do it right, they feed each other. They don't diminish. The narrative doesn't get lost. The narrative bridges between those two. And I think if you can do that, it's fabulous. I try to do a little bit of it. It'd be fun someday to try and do it more radically.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean, whose new film is Noise. But you're talking – even Rivette often uses polemic. I mean, those films are certainly openly political.
Well, Paris Belongs to Us, I think, is openly political, but it's in a narrative. You know, I don't know in the end exactly what the politics of that are, but I know that there's a mystery of people disappearing, which is never fully resolved. And that unresolved mystery, I think, has a kind of projective power. It takes you beyond the narrative and beyond the polemic and beyond the ideas into a mystery that can't, you know, into that contemplation of mystery.
But those times the movie really plays, we were just talking about, you had a chance to show the movie at the AFI Dallas Film Fest.
Right.
Audience that really responded to it.
Loved it. As I was saying to you before we started here, I was standing outside the theater and they were laughing so hard I thought I was at the wrong theater because I'd wanted people to laugh that hard. I never had heard it before. So it was a delight to be down there. They were great. They were a great audience.
But that's that thing, too, where at that point the movie has totally sort of moved away from the essay and is completely satisfying to the audience because it's built to a climax.
Well, but wait. An essay doesn't have to be unsatisfying to an audience. The first comment in the first screening in Dallas was a young woman, I think from somewhere in Latin America, who said, "I want to thank you for making a movie that's about something important." So to her, the idea is came through. And I think what you said earlier about the fable-like quality, there is a simplicity to the narrative here. And I think that allows things to – the story of Kyuju. Remember that film?
Sure.
By Zhang Yimou? That was also a fable. And I thought it didn't detract from the psychological realism or the behavioral realism of the characters, but it suggested another level of excitement. You know, what you get often in older literature that we don't have today. You get it in Milton.
As you were talking about Kyuju, I was just thinking about how bleached of color this film is. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of grays in it.
Mm-hmm.
Grays, blues, and blacks.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly kind of reacting to people's faces.
Right.
And that aural sensation you were talking about,
right,
being moved
right,
around
right.
by this disturbance in the air.
Right. Yes. The city kind of is porous in some way in the film. It's not a beautiful, gleaming picture postcard city. It's this grungy thing that looms over us that's almost insubstantial in a certain way.
But also this sort of thing that because there's no visual distraction, you have to react to the noise. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it feels
mm-hmm.
like mm-hmm. there's nothing for people to look at.
Right. You know, the ultimate here would have been to have moments when – and there is one of my favorite moments in the movie is where nothing's really happening at all on screen But the sound is, things are happening in the sound. And no one's reacting to the sound. The sound is like in his head there, and he's not angry. He's, in a certain sense, it's shortly after he's moved downtown. And he's just sitting in a chair by the window of his new studio apartment. And he's just letting the noise wash over him.
See, because I wondered, I almost wondered to some extent how much of this was in his head and how much of it we were supposed to believe wasn't really happening except for him, because experientially, and not for really anybody else.
I think that's right. I think that if you or someone else had been in those situations, we might not have heard the sounds that were driving him crazy. But if you take the first scene, he's sitting in his living room quite contentedly listening to his wife play the cello. She's a classical cellist. And at some point, he is disturbed by something, which we don't hear. And he gets up and goes to the window, and he opens the window, and now we hear the car alarm. It's a choice by him at that moment. It's a choice to hear that sound. Or one might say, he's so happy, he needs to hear some sound that's bothering him. His happiness is more than he can bear.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Henry Bean. His new film as a writer-director is Noise. So many of the other protagonists in the films that you've written seem more adult, and he seems more childish.
Yes.
But by the end, he's the one who has actually achieved something. He's grown up. He's moved to another stage in his life in a way these other guys have not been able to.
He's not locked into it the way the other guys
are. You talked about obsession. I think it feels more to me like kind of an irritation that he needs something to hold on to, and his family life and his work life, whatever, those things aren't offering him the kind of satisfaction he gets from holding on to this thing that just annoys him to death.
Well, his anger is very powerful to him. You know, St. Augustine says something like, where there's anger, there's hope. I think that it has to be said that while this issue had preoccupied me for 20 years or more, the current historical moment fed into it strongly. And the sense that there are forces in history and there are things happening in the nation about that are driving you crazy and about which you can't do anything. And maybe then what you have to do is find something, however small, that you can do something about.
Well, Henry, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Will you make your film about your artistic obsession, please come back and talk about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's great having you here. Thanks for doing
this. Sure.
My guest is writer-director Henry Bean. His new film as writer-director is Noise. Our technical director here at Carnegie Recording Studios is Lashik Wojcik. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Stop banging that thing. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.